The Blue Cliff Record, Case 98, Chanping's Two Wrongs. Chanping, called Kangji, visited Zhijuan while on pilgrimage. He was always saying, "Don't say you have understood Buddhism. There is no one who can make a Zen dialogue with me and examine me." One day, Zhijuan saw him at a distance and called to him, "Come here, Kangji." Chanping raised his head. Zhijuan said, "Wrong." Chanping went on for two or three steps. Zhijuan said, "Wrong." Chanping turned and came closer. Zhijuan said, "I have just said wrong twice. Is it I who am wrong, or is it you?" Chanping said, "It is I." Zhijuan said, "Wrong." Chanping was silent. Zhijuan said, "Stay here for the summer retreat, and I'll examine this matter of two wrongs with you." Chanping, however, departed. Years later, when Chanping became an abbot, he addressed his assembly and said, "Once in my days of pilgrimage, I visited Zhijuan by chance, and twice he said wrong. He advised me to stay with him for the summer retreat to examine this matter of two wrongs with him. I don't say I was wrong then, but when I left for the south, I realized for the first time that I had completed saying wrong." So, I'd like to look at this koan with you, and hopefully I'll get a bit of it wrong. When I, decades ago, when I was a monastic practitioner, my first teacher was doing a mando, a Zen dialogue, and he said, "Here's how Zen works. If the student comes in and points to the absolute, the teacher points to the relative. If the student points to the relative, the teacher points to the absolute. If the student points to both, the teacher points to neither. If the student points to neither, the teacher points to both." And he said, "This is how Zen teaching works." And I said, "How is that not just being an asshole?" The heart of this koan is this wrong. This wrong. What is it? Is this the wrong that stands in opposition to right? Or is this something else? In one of the verses of the Mumon Kan, Master Mumon says, "If you judge right and wrong, you are a person of right and wrong." Is Zhijuan a person of right and wrong? Dogen invites us to meet practice as one continuous mistake. Continuous mistake. Meeting this wrong that fills the entire universe. This all-inclusive, non-dual wrong. This is where we are invited to sit in the middle of, in Shikantaza. This koan also evokes for me one of my other favorite koans, where a similarly haughty know-it-all had some realization, feeling really good about himself. Monk goes to see a master, comes into the zendo, and makes three circles around the master's seat. And the master says, "Right, right." My favorite part of this koan, that koan, is Zhuedo's comment. After the teacher says, "Right, right," Zhuedo inserts himself and says, "Mistake." The koan goes on, and the haughty monk goes to visit another master, walks in to the Zendo, does his three circles around the Zen seat. And the master says, "Not right, not right." And Zhuedo interjects, "Mistake." Is this mistake a criticism? Is this wrong a problem? Where are we falling into becoming people of right and wrong? One of the great gifts of this practice, the great gifts of Zazen, is to let go of our stories of right and wrong. And in this way, Zazen is uniquely important. This letting go of right and wrong doesn't mean that outside of Zazen we don't acknowledge the reality of harm causing and try not to do harm causing. We don't, and this is what the precepts remind us for. But in Zazen, in Shikantaza, in the Shikantaza that is not in the categories of things that can be done right or wrong, we let go of right and wrong. We entrust ourselves beyond this right and wrong. We entrust ourselves in the middle of this wrong. We so much want to be right. We want to be certain. We want to know. This isn't actually what the endeavor is about. My favorite piece of this koan, I really appreciate the generosity of Zhi Yuan. He says, "I have just said wrong twice. Is it I who am wrong, or is it you?" Chanping falls on his sword here and says, "It is I." Is that true? Is that true even for him? Zhi Yuan says, "Wrong." My favorite part is this. Zhi Yuan then says, "Stay here for this summer retreat, for this ango, and I'll examine this matter of two wrongs with you." What love, what kindness, examining this matter of two wrongs, examining this matter of one wrong, examining this matter of no wrong. Jian Ping, however, departed. And then he goes on to make it into a story. I want to encourage all of you to, during this retreat, let us together examine this matter of two wrongs. Let us together meet beyond right and wrong, in the middle of this one wrong that fills the entire world. This one wrong, which is another name for all of this as it is. This one wrong that contains in it not the least bit of a seed of criticism. You don't have to wait the entire summer to examine this matter of two wrongs. Melissa will clarify it for you right now.
Thank you, Josh. Because we have four guiding teachers here this weekend, and there are only two opportunities for Taisho, as is our custom sometimes, we agreed to share our talks, and Josh and I are giving the talk today, and when I'm done saying something or other, we'll have our Dharma dialogue following. But this koan is something that has been haunting me personally all through our Ango period, the three-week period that preceded this session, and that many of you were involved in various ways. What I noticed happening often to so many of us was this rising up, not of wrong as projected outward, but as wrong as interjected, as taken in, almost as if we're all carrying the filters of wrong, so that sometimes an innocuous remark, a fleeting moment from another person was filtered and taken in as wrong. This wrong that we hang around with, as Josh was pointing out, is not the wrong that this teacher in this koan is playing with, is using as an invitational hook for the student. When Si Yuan, the teacher, sees Tianping, he must have that sense already of a person of right and wrong. Because, frankly, every one of us is a person of right and wrong, even though the great teachers of the past and the great teachers of the present admonish us, invite us, really, with a great open heart to drop it, to not get caught. We get caught. And there are many ways of working with this, many ways of witnessing, we might say appreciating, how we get caught. In the heart of Zen practice, the one who can see the hook, feel it in our mouth, feel the pain of the grip of it, this moment of feeling when we get caught in right and wrong is an amazing moment. And I gotta tell you, if you haven't noticed already, Zen is full of opportunities. All the forms, all the turning to the left, turning to the right, where you put your chopsticks and your spoon and how you navigate in Kinhin. So many opportunities for this deeply rooted sense of wrong. This one continuous mistake of Dogen, Shunryu Suzuki used to say, one humiliation after the other, is an invitation and not meant to be a punishment. An invitation to see how deep it goes. How when we were very, very, very young, we got indoctrinated into the school of right and wrong, because it protected us for a little while. It taught us that if the stove is glowing red, we don't touch it because it would be wrong. Ouch. A very simple version of wrong. But then we make it a fetish. We make it the cloth that covers us so that everything we see is colored by it. And in Zen practice, we really get to see this. This is the initial step, to really feel how we are in the grips of judgment continually, without pause, until we recognize it. That moment when we see it, when we see that we've been doing it, often about ourselves, but some of us have personalities where we tend to judge others first. Doesn't matter. It's still the same patterning. To see it, to feel it, to recognize what we've been doing hurts. It's really, really painful to feel that grip. To feel that hook. To feel how we've been separating the world into these categories. For as long as we've had language, for as long as we've been conscious little beings, the moment when it transforms is so early, the moment when we get caught. And there's another aspect to this. It feels safe to be caught. The Zen practice, the great Zen practice of being an asshole, is quite an old tradition in Zen. It goes all the way back to this koan and many others, where people come forward because they've had some taste, some experience, and then because this hook of right and wrong is so I don't even know the word, relentless, I guess, relentless. We then filter whatever Zen experiences we've had, whatever experiences of awakening, of insight, of the growth of compassion, we filter them through right and wrong. And one of the reasons that I happen to love this koan, although it always stops my mouth up, I actually had picked it out myself, and then last night I was up for hours thinking, where do I start? How do I make an entry point? And so I picked another koan, and I asked Josh, because we were sharing it, if we could do the other koan. He was agreeable, you know, and then he said, but you know, this koan. And I said, could you start it? Could you find the entry point? And you heard him. He did. I'm so grateful. Because in that entry point, it becomes clear once again to me where this koan is so helpful. And it's helpful because it shows us these two people of the way, sincere practitioners. And one of them, as Josh pointed out, the teacher, Si Yuan, is so compassionate. He keeps trying. He keeps pointing out. This wrong is a little bit like mu, isn't it? It's not a no that has a yes in it, that has a yes that's the opposite of it. It is a wrong that has no right. It's just, hey. He could have said, hey, but wrong is a little richer. Wrong is where we get caught. And we have to realize that when we study koans, we have to get deep inside both people or all the people in the koan. So we have to feel Si Yuan's compassion, as Josh spoke of him. This deeply compassionate teacher doing his best when he sees someone so caught to guide, not necessarily gently, but directly, because this is so important. And our friend Tianping, he just doesn't get it. And there are many commentators on this koan who believe, and I feel like I have to join them, that he never got it. The invitation, stay, and we'll examine this matter of wrong together. Nope. I already know what I have to know. Nobody can make a mandala with me. Can you feel it? Have you been there? Many of us have. I know all about Zen because of blah, blah, blah. And you don't know anything because of blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter what the reasons are. It's this contraction of the heart-mind. So we have to feel that contraction of the heart-mind before we can be free of it. We have to see it. We have to feel its pain. We have to feel how much harm it does in the world, the holding ourselves apart, the being in the asshole position. Many great teachers have lived there. Many, many students live there till the day they die. Don't be one of them. Please. Wrong. Wrong. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. And people who are on the other side of the fireplace, please feel free to move in and fill in any gaps you find in the Zendo so you can be part of what is now going to be our discussion, our Dharma dialogue, which is where you get to speak up. And I don't know if we're going to use wrong as a weapon, but be wrong. Go ahead, take a chance. Say something that's true for you, something that that got sparked by this talk, or some insight, or some question, something you want to ask. And all four of us will do our best to engage with you. Yes, Christine.
Oh, thank you. With the bright red sweater, and I saw everybody else in dark clothes, I thought, oh, I did not get the memo. And when I was called to the parlor, I thought, uh-oh. Listening to both of you, I want to cry and laugh at the same time, because it loosens up a rigidity in me that I'm grateful for, and it gives me much more of a sense of freedom and fun at the same time. And when you were also talking about that right and wrong, which boy, I do it to myself and others, and that hook, I was feeling a fish hook of how I can get myself caught up in that. So, thank you.
I appreciate your naming the spirit of play there, and want to encourage all of us to play freely in this field of nothing but wrong.
So at the risk of sounding like an asshole, I noticed that, well, let me preface this by saying one thing that I've learned again and again in Dharma Sway that I really appreciate is not to draw a firm line between my Zen practice and the rest of my life. And I noticed that in this particular, the way that this koan was discussed, it really kind of stayed within the Zendo. It really kind of stayed within the monastery, where people might say wrong out of compassion, and where we have these forms that we can, you know, we put our chopsticks wrong, and it's kind of, you know, that we can do a kind of a Zen thing with it. But outside of here, the world is filled with people who will tell us wrong, not out of compassion, but to exert dominance or to put us down out of sadistic reasons, to try to make us feel bad about ourselves. And, you know, many people, I mean, everyone in this room has either had a supervisor like that at work, or a parent, or a partner, or a
college teacher, professor. Maybe.
A college professor.
Just for an example.
Just at random.
I don't know why that came to mind.
So how do, you know, so what do we do with that? How do we keep from letting our Zen instincts help us participate in our own victimization and meet a kind of sadistic impulse with a masochistic, oh, you know, water flows and goes to the low places.
Oh, no, and that, I'm not sure that's what you're saying, but David really wants to answer that question.
It reminds me of Tori Zenji's vow. You know, when people are treat us bitterly, it's best to bow down. This is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own attachments. So it's about this bowing down. And Alan, I think you're quite right to point out that there's a real difference between this and allowing people to walk all over us. Mm-hmm. That part of our Zen training is to stand our ground, to stand in our own shoes, and to not abandon our own experience. You know, not to a Zen teacher, not to a boss, not to someone else, any other person. And there is some possibility whenever I get hooked. You know, so someone appears and sometimes I, you know, it's important to say no. Sometimes it's important to leave the situation. It's so important to protect ourselves and to believe in ourselves. And in the arising of the reactivity, I can feel there is some way I have been hooked over and over again by believing someone else rather than myself. So not an either-or situation, not like either I just, sort of allow myself to be victimized, but also some opportunity. So sometimes important to take action, to say something, to do something, sometimes not important, but always some possibility. I might have been Josh, or somebody else, but said that for the poor student needs a good teacher. For the good student, any asshole will do. So always some opportunity.
Certainly lets us off the hook. But you know, the other thing too, I'm just coming at this from another place. So the Zendo is a microcosm of the world. Things are quite a bit simpler here. Really, once you get used to everything, it's quite a bit simpler. I'm just trying to reassure some of you new folks. So the arising that David was talking about of reactivity that happens here, we're allowed to see how it works. Zen practice is not a formula for strategizing how to be in the world. It's a way of learning how we already are and then moving from that place. And I think it's important to not make too strong a division, except that it's simpler here and way more complicated when we go out into the world where all the bodhisattvas are waiting, all the Buddhas are waiting to beat us down, perhaps.
Can I just add one small piece? So even when we hold our place, as David is suggesting, even when we say, no, something is wrong, to do that from a place beyond right and wrong. And this is what the Kanungyo tells us with regard to this Buddha who we awaken right here. This Buddha receives only compassion. Which isn't a filter, isn't saying, hey, no, sorry, I'm only taking compassion right now. But in the receiving, it lets things be alchemically transformed into compassion. And then we can meet that as we trust our experience, as we do what needs doing.
Mike?
Me?
I think.
That was my hand. So one of the I forget who says this, but in a case somewhere along the way, there's a response where someone says, you can only know your consciousness till now. The one can only know. I really like that in relation to this case. I think of the place of standing and saying, you know, taking your ground. There is a quality of some sort of story that's informing that, that comes out of our past lives in some way. And then on the flip side of that, there's a way that underlying this certain story, right, about the way things have been, there's a deeper ocean of I actually don't know how things are. I don't know how they're going to be. And so I feel like there's this potential in that kind of opening to the moment, the aliveness of the moment, the thusness of this, where the story is like this surface thing going on, And it doesn't mean it disappears, for at least not for me. And it means that sometimes I align with it, but in some way, maybe underneath that, I don't really know. And that is very liberating for me.
Thank you.
It reminds me of a poem by a Jewish theologian who said that God disturbs us toward our destiny. And that this disturbance that arises, so we can hold to right and wrong, and the emotional imperative comes up, said, how dare you say that to me? I won't stand for. And in the energy of that, in the disturbance of that, I love you pointing to something beyond that, that maybe we can have entry to something only when the usual story is disturbed. It's broken apart in some way. So some potential of this compassion underlying that. Yeah.
And I appreciate this vast ocean of not knowing how things even are. And when we really entrust ourselves to that, then the how things will be becomes much less important.
I'm reminded of an incident that happened because this was in graduate school, so maybe it will speak to you, I don't know, of how differently two people can receive the same situation. So I think it was biochemistry, not really a strong suit for me, but the professor asked a question, and I thought that I knew what the answer was. I had a pretty good, I was pretty sure of it, but I dared not risk, just in case. But the person who was sitting next to me raised his hand, and he gave an answer, and it was the wrong one. And so the teacher proceeded to tell him, you know, no, that's not right, you know, and explain what was the right one. And I thought, oh, thank goodness that I didn't, you know, take a chance and offer my answer, which wouldn't have been right. So afterwards, I spoke with this person after the class and said, you know, it must have been really difficult for you, you know, to have, you know, taken this chance to answer and gotten it wrong. You must have felt really bad. I felt for you, you know. He's like, no, I thought it was great, you know, because I didn't know the answer and I got it straightened out. And it just struck me how very different that was from how I had looked at it. And that so much relies on how we receive and who we're trying to protect in that not receiving it.
Steve?
So I really noticed while you were talking, and I've been noticing today anyway, about how, you know, I have this very strong preference for being right over being wrong, and how I have kind of this default position of, you know, I can take most any input, like Kate is talking about, and use that for me as a way to, you know, to feel like I am wrong. And, you know, it seems to me that it's not this preference to be right over to be wrong is not exactly a problem. That, you know, I just want to do my best, you know, and I keep, you know, calling myself forward in spite of, you know, feeling this this danger of, you know, falling into wrong. And you know, it doesn't seem to me like something to be eliminated exactly. I mean, this wrong is kind of inevitable. I mean, when do we ever, you know, hit the mark dead center? You know, we We try our best and we fall short. And to be able to tolerate is maybe as far as I can go. This idea of being wrong and to show up anyway, in spite of feeling that way a lot of the time. Seems, valuable to me to not have to eliminate this feeling of being wrong. That, you know, even this deep feeling of wrongness, to just sit with that and see that for what it is. Just. Seems like a good practice for me.
That I do a whole lot.
Sure.
I love this case too. I mean, it really is important to me, and one of the reasons I really like it is that it, you know, it's got all these hooks in it, and a big subset of koans have ways of taking them that move us away from the koanic point. And and this one is like a humdinger, you know, with Ra. And when Josh and Melissa presented, I was thinking, well, you know, two beautiful talks, but the order is wrong.
And there you go.
So for me, I like this kind of orderly progression that you could go from the relative to the absolute, and it's all kind of clean and wonderful. And I can't remember now whether it was Melissa or Josh, because they kind of blend in my mind. One of them said that when we deal with the wrong, you know, we need to remember that the deep wrong behind it. Mm-hmm. And actually the ordering was perfect, because it presented for us what our project of the weekend, you know, is to really delve into the place of neither right nor wrong, that deep wrong that has no opposite, the two wrongs, the matter of the two wrongs, where we are spending our entire summer over the next 2 days working with that. And each of us brings in, you know, such a beautiful presentation of the deep wounded wrong that so many of us feel. And some, I don't know if it's human or cultural, but it's so intimate it doesn't matter. For us, this wounded wrongness is something we have to deal with. And what I love about what we do here, what our project is that deep wrong, stepping away from categories wrong, the matter of the two wrongs, is rich and beautiful, and can, if we open ourselves to it, allow us to engage this other wrong, these wounded wrongs, these shortcomings, these failures, these things that haunt us, just and unjust, can become the actual way. It can become the deep wrong. And it is a delicate proposition, and you have to be careful when you go out in the world where people will use the wrong to as a weapon. And we need to find the balance and the harmonies. But here we've given ourselves this moment where we can actually see how our shortcoming, just or unjust, is an opening into this great and beautiful thing.
Just to take a thread from Stephen, what you just said, James, about this letting go proposition, you know, that I think you're pointing to how important our way is opening the hand of thought. It's not pitching things into the refuse. Right? So whatever is arising is what we work with, and we do it as much as we can from that open place. Yeah.
just want to add one small thing. Steve, I think you're selling yourself short by saying tolerate is as far as you can go. as far as you do go. I think that there's actually a peaceful coexistence that you have accompanied by this deep feeling of wrong. Tolerate implies, okay, I can tolerate it. But I think that the thing that you are continually demonstrating is, you know, this shadow of wrong always on your heels, and still you are meeting everything around you with such love. So I won't say that you befriend, but I think far beyond tolerate. And this is our practice, not just to tolerate what's here.
There's two.
Yeah, so.
One of the things that I love about this poem is that there are a number of wonderful images that I'm likely to remember, and that might help me in confronting my own sense of being in the wrong. I don't think I would have understood it, really, except for the two wonderful talks. But having understood it to the extent that I can, the question is, how do I remember it at appropriate moments? And the image of the student in the koan who is hailed in this manner and who turns his head and receives the word wrong. And then he takes a couple of steps, and again, he hears the word wrong. I mean, he is obviously a person of right and wrong, and so am I. I feel myself in his position, and can recall the numerous times and the numerous ways in which people have said to me, wrong. I'm grateful for that. And it also, Melissa mentioned that, of course, the entire sesshin is set up the forms are set up so as to reinforce that lesson, because we wonder whether we're doing it right. Particularly for me, having learned the forms of another school and become somewhat habituated to them, and therefore perhaps forgetting what they're meant to accomplish, I am noticing very much that I'm looking to see if I'm in the wrong here, because I'm not habituated to the forms, which is a good thing. What the forms should do, but how to counteract the force of habit. So I will remember those images for a little while. I did want to say something about the end of the koan. Josh said something like, then he goes off and makes a story of it. And I don't know that we know what happens to him. I mean, that's probably true, and that's one of the possibilities. But I think he says something like, it was then I ceased to say wrong. If that is really true, then I think maybe he got it. He realized that he didn't have to stay for the summer. Anyway, it doesn't matter to me because I'm not there, but I just could not resist.
I was thinking about being at work where I'm one of four women in a plant with 120 people that are mostly men. And I can get passionate about what's going on, and every single year I get told to not let my customers get under my skin or upset me. And I thought about that, and I'm like, I think their real issue is that I let stuff going on with me get under my skin. And taking that a step further back than now, realizing I just had that so squashed until I started a meditation practice at 19. And now I get to sit here in this sendo and laugh and cry and watch the whole range float by or grip me hard on that hook. It's an interesting view.
Dominic and then Bob.
So coming back to this end of the story, he said something like, I didn't stay, but I was done saying wrong. So what did he say? I was done saying wrong.
Right. I think you're pointing to something very, very important. It's that I am done problem. Right? You know that anyone has ever had a sort of completion experience, right? Graduation, getting tenure, getting a huge grant from the NIH, since I'm looking at Bob, all these successes, and then we say, great, I'm done, and then what happens next? That's a really important question. What happens next? So is there done? You know, that, I think this the end of the koan, there are all these commentaries on the story-making aspect of that ending, you know, that he just put it a little neat bow and packaged it. But if we really get inside his feeling of being done, it's a little bit like the feeling of being wrong. It's got that same, it should have that same hook. You know, done.
I have to admit, for me, it kind of bookends his original thing. Yeah, nobody can check him. And yet there's this beautiful invitation to all of us. I like that he doesn't appear to really completely get it. He's still a teacher, and he's a guide for all of us, because we're being invited to, within our wrongs, about wrong.
Yes.
Back to the, it's always right there. It's always presenting. Everything is a gate for us, if we're willing.
If we're willing.
And completing saying wrong, never again saying wrong, this isn't the goal. Glorying in wrong, playing freely in the vast field of wrong. Wrong, 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 wrong! Rejoicing in wrong.
As anybody who has explored the source of Mu knows.
Anybody who's explored by Bajang's Fox. And anybody who's explored...
anybody who's ever lived a life.
Yeah. Anybody who's... yeah? Hands? Anybody who's ever lived a life? Yeah. And Bob?
I was just thinking that the place, one of the most intimate places where I get into this whole swirl of right and wrong is my zazen. I mean, that I'm just constantly, oh, wait, no, now I'm thinking about the next meal. That's wrong. And then I kind of, you know, no, I'm supposed to be doing this. I'm not supposed to be doing that. And what we are told all the time is that we can't judge our practice. And I do it over and over and over again. It just keeps... But what I'm realizing is that it's sort of like what we're saying, that it's never finished. I will always... These judgments keep coming up, but I'm maybe beginning to befriend them a little. It's like, oh yeah, oh yeah. It's like nothing left. I'm not trying to get rid of the judgments. That's we can't. And that it's just, yeah, okay, yeah, here it is. Here it is. Me telling me what I should be doing.
And I think that's the invitation from the teacher of stay.
Yeah. Stay. Stay.
Yeah. Right. Stay. Just stay. Let's explore this. This is what we're doing here. You know, round after round, we are staying.
Oh. And then Derek.
This talk reminds me of that children's game where you're trying to find somebody, and somebody else is leading you, saying, warmer, warmer, older, and I know with a bigger brother, there, you know, he would, you know, he would start me off warmer and colder, and then after a while, he would just keep saying colder, and so, you know, I get caught by myself, like, well, where do I go, what do I do, and there comes a point where you wonder if he's messing with you or not. And you can either get caught by your, you know, like, I'm doing it wrong, where should I go? Or getting mad at him, or you could just confront him and start wrestling with him. And so I wonder what would have happened in his car if that person just went up to the teacher and started wrestling with him if he would keep saying, wrong.
Yeah, I mean, there are many cons where that does happen.
Sounds like a great answer.
Yeah.
Wrong.
I'm ready.
Wrong.
It's dope sound.
It's going to be weird. It's a
shame. Kestrel and then Susan, and then I think we'll come to an ending, perhaps. But it's Kestrel and then Susan.
I noticed today when I was noticing thoughts happening that when I stopped, I happened to have a moment of stopping to think some thoughts, like one thought was special and one thought was not special. I stopped doing that for a moment, and which is kind of like, I guess, right and wrong. And I noticed that when that stopped for a moment, I didn't feel a sense of rightness. I just felt a kind of connectivity and almost like a feeling of love. And it was interesting because it wasn't that the opposite of it wasn't that thinking was wrong and when I stopped doing that I was right. I just, when nothing was kind of special, it wasn't that everything felt right. It just felt not right. Yeah. This was like a good feeling.
you've said it really clearly, and this what you're describing is intimacy.
Yeah.
This. And intimacy is very different than, okay, I'm sure I'm right now.
Exactly.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Susan, you have the last word of Zen.
I've been thinking, as people have been talking, that in a way, the right and wrong and the mindset of right and wrong is one aspect of wanting to be protected.
I,
if I just subscribe to the right belief or stand on the right foot, I'll be protected forever. And I think sometimes people really get into right and wrong because they feel, well, I can manipulate this. And then if I always point to the right button, then I'm protected forever. But one of the things I really appreciate about Zen is there's a fundamental admission that there's not anything you can do that will protect you forever. That's not going to happen. That's not where we live. And then you have to try to get all right with going on living unprotected with no magic button.
Deep bows.
Amen.
Thank you all. That was the last word.